Welcome to the Chryson podcast, where we bring you regular updates on the construction, engineering, and property industries. This podcast was recorded live on the 16th of February 2017 in Sydney and features Andrew Harris. Andrew is a University of Sydney professor and the Australian director of Langer Rourke's Future Engineering and Innovation Consultancy, the Engineering Excellence Group.
I presume that, like me, most of you are here because innovation and construction is a pretty short talk, right? It is, right? The last major disruptive innovation in construction was the invention of the brick 5,000 years ago by the aliens who built the pyramids. So, tell me another one. There isn't one, right?
Yeah. Portland cement.
Sorry?
Portland cement.
Yeah, maybe. So that's a Roman invention. And it's about 700 years old. So, okay, let's move up from 5,000 to 700. Structural steel's been along about half that time. So that's basically it. So I came along actually to drink your alcohol and have some food. So we're basically done. Thanks very much for coming. Let's see if we can get you to the canapes really quickly. I need to do a couple of prefacing remarks. I have a complicated set of jobs. So I am a very part-time professor at the University of Sydney. I have a lab there that grows gold on trees and reverse engineers butterflies and does some quite unusual things like that. There's more crossover between my role at Langer Rourke and the university than you'd imagine, actually. I'm also a director of Langer Rourke, PLC. So I don't belong to our Australian business, the operating business in Australia. I belong to the group and they're headquartered in London. So my role is a global role. And I do little bits and pieces. I live in Sydney. And I am Australian a long time ago. And I've lived in South Africa and the UK and a whole bunch of other places in my career. And my boss at the moment is Irish, so I have funny Irish. Apologies for that. So if you have a complaint tonight about me and what I'm talking about, there's always complaints at the end of my talks. Don't write to the University of Sydney, please. There's a special person at Langer Rourke when you ring the switchboard that just deals with me. So ask for Sharon, she will sort you right out. That's how that goes. All right, so it's a small group, so that's good. So I'm happy to take questions or comments as we're going through. We'll see how we go. If it gets out of hand, I'll call the bouncers. All right. Anyone seen this before? These are called Kondratiev cycles. This is the only bit where I'm going to be a professor tonight. Seen these before? So if you chart, in this case, the US share market going back a couple of hundred years, you're looking at the peaks where there's exponential growth, right? And they correlate pretty well with some of the major industrial developments over time. So the advent of the steam engine, the railways, the petrochem boom, automobiles, IT. The reason for showing you this is not my work. This was pulled together by a bunch of bankers, including an RBS and others. Kondratiev was a Russian mathematician from the 1800s. This stuff is reasonably well known if you're a financial person or a banker. The point of me showing you this is we're due another one. In fact, we're well overdue. So then everybody is postulating about what that might be. Is it biotech, nanotech, the Internet of Things, big data, robotics, automation, computer vision? Right? But the point is nobody knows. But none of those things have ever been thrown around in anger on a construction site. And that's the reason that I like this role. In my other life, so my lab is the largest manufacturer of graphene and carbon nanotubes, so super materials. A carbon nanotube is 10,000 times thinner than the hair in your head, and it's 12 times stronger than steel, six times lighter. Twisted one way, it's a perfect insulator. Twisted the other, it's a perfect conductor. So if I make a building out of that or a piece of paper, then the piece of paper is bulletproof. And the building doesn't have columns that look like that. They're the size of my pinky. So it fundamentally transforms how that goes. And if I write a paper or do some work in graphing, then in 3 hours, there are research groups around the world that have reverse engineered it. And they've chucked 100 bodies at it. And I've got one person, because Australia's really expensive labour place to do work, right? And you just can't do it. There's no competition. Right? In construction, we've got long time horizons, really long time horizons. So it gives us some time and some space to do this sort of stuff. Alright, so my my friends in the corporate comms team at AORC just want me to do one little thing and share some background about us as a business. We're Australia's largest privately owned engineering, manufacturing, and construction company. Not very well known. They tend to hide their light under a bushel a little bit. Have I done something wrong? Okay. So in Australia, we're one of the largest oil and gas contractors. I think we're working on 5 of the 6 mega projects, or have worked on 5 of the 6 mega projects that have gone on recently. One of the largest mining and mineral processing contractors. We're finishing off the Pacific Highway in partnership with the RMS, New South Wales Government, and Parsons Brinckerhoff. This delivery model was the one that was used and that we used on the London Olympics. So it's the first delivery partner model for delivering a mega project in Australia. It's 150 kilometres, about $6 billion worth of work. And we do no construction. Absolutely none. We haven't wielded a shovel in anger on that project, which again is a view into the future. We do lots and lots of rail work. We're a really big rail business. We've been maintaining the urban network in Sydney for as long as I can remember, 25 or 30 years now, in one form or another. We're doing the new transfer station in Perth for the new stadium. We do lots of social and economic infrastructure, hospitals, airports, schools, those sorts of things, including the new clinical services building in Blacktown. We dig very large holes in the ground. This one's in Hong Kong. If you walk past the convention centre in Hong Kong, walk very softly. There's a very thin layer of concrete, and that hole is below it. And this sort of stuff, I'll show you this picture. It's a bit old now. This is one of my favourite jobs. So I'm a chemical engineer by background, so I know nothing about geotech or structural engineering. But there's a live railway line that runs to the top of that picture with a train that goes every 30 seconds at peak. So they had a sign on the bottom of these columns that said, don't back into it with an excavator. 4 different languages while I'm digging a hole. I'm not sure that was the right answer, but to give you an idea of how big that hole is. That's the 901 project in Hong Kong. And we do lots and lots of defence work, including at Amberley at the moment, all throughout Australia. I think we're doing defence jobs in every state and the territories at the moment. All right, so that's the corporate bit. I don't have to do that. There'll be a spy here from Langerhoff's comms team making sure I did that. So what I'm going to do for the next sort of 25, 30 minutes is just step through how we build something, anything you like. Doesn't matter if it's an oil and gas refinery or a railway line. And I'm going to show you the things that you need in our world, like the future of construction looks like. And as I'm going through, I'm going to step forward in time as well. So the stuff we're talking about early on in the talk exists today or a few years ago. We get to the middle, it's stuff that we're doing now for the first time. Towards the end, it's things that I reckon we'll see in the next couple of years. That's all right. Okay. Nobody's left yet. Nobody's got bags of fruit. All right, so when you're delivering an asset, the first thing you need is a digital model. I think everybody knows what BIM is today. We don't like BIM as a moniker, building information modeling. Like what if you're building something that's not a building, right? What if it's a railway line? Is BIM relevant? I don't think so. Do you call it infrastructure information modeling then? Railway information modeling? It just gets really confusing. I don't like it. So somebody who wasn't Langerhoff coined a term called digital engineering, which we borrowed, we really like. Some people call it virtual design and construction. I don't mind. The central tenet is you have a 3D model that is the single source of truth on your project. So today, this is a model that is 5 years old. Anyone guess the project? I'm not supposed to show this. So it is the largest construction project in the world at the moment. It happens to be in Australia. Come on, that's got to give it away. It's in Western Australia. second guess.
King Square. Sorry, King Square.
The largest in the world is.
No. Project.
Gas project. Wheatstone. Chevron's Wheatstone project. 50, 60, 70, whatever it says in the latest reports, $1 billion. It's a big project. We had a tiny little scope. It's basically a very, very large concrete slab. Very, very expensive concrete slab. All the compressors to sit on top of. So from this model, we issue all of the drawings that go to the contractors and the subcontractors and the supply shop, so the IFC documentation. We do all of our logistics plans and management. Value engineering is done in the model. We issue rack-eyed iPads to site, and they've got a digital model, so and you do your quality control and your checklists are all done digitally, and they all automatically update. And to the point where we do contract reviews using the model now. So you press a button, it spits out a contract review pack each month. It saved an enormous amount of results. So I'll tell you a quick little story. This was the first project we tried these iPads with a model in it and some quality stuff on this project. And I rang Apple and I pretended I was an academic and I borrowed a dozen iPads from Apple through the education program. And I loaded them up with some software, I sent them out to site. And this was a great job. Most of the engineers on this job were female, of the site engineers, there were eight. And I said, look, this is what we're doing. Can you test it for me? Try and break it, see how it works. I'll be by in a couple of months to come and get them back. I've got to get them back to Apple and give them some deals. So I rang them up at the end. I said, where are my iPads? And they're like, oh, Andrew, we're really sorry. We lost them. And I'm like, you've lost them all? They went, yep, we lost them all. And I was really cross because I thought they nicked them and were watching movies and stuff. And it turned out they didn't want to give them back because the stuff was really useful. I did like a sneaky visit. Tell them I was coming because I had to get them back. And they were using them. So now all of our jobs in all over the world use a tablet of some description with all of this stuff on it so that there is a single source of truth. It's the number one thing. So you don't get to the end of a job. And we have literally projects with tons of paperwork all out of sync at the end of projects historically. So I have a 7-year-old. So I've got three kids. They're all, I'm sure the eldest is 7, and he calls this a Captain Obvious. This is the sort of stuff you do, and that is accompanied by a big eye roll and then a storm off in the down the hallway. So how are we doing? We're all good. So the model, so the three dimensions of the model, the price is in there, the program is in there, you change the program, it changes the price, it automatically updates, you change the model, all those things are interrelated, right? It's a bit of a kind of obvious. I'll give you an example. This is my my Hong Kong project again. So that's our scope, this little bit here. We modeled the reinforcement cage on this project. This was the first time I've done this. We've done it in our UK business before. And this is the clash detection algorithm. This is quite a complicated node structurally and has an enormous load on it. And we were trying to decide if you do bottom-up construction or top-down. But you see here, it's unconstructable. Right? It is an unconstructable design. So the engineers have come up with this. We modeled the rebar down to 2 millimeters. And that went through the value engineering workshop, and the guys redesigned how it would be built, and they changed the design. And everyone was like, that was pretty good, we enjoyed that. I'll tell you where it really paid dividends. We're about to start construction of the first nuclear power station in the UK since Sizewell B in the late 70s, early 80s, at Hinkley Point. And the last nuclear power station in Europe that was started still hasn't finished. It's 9 years late, and about €8 billion over budget. Which concerns me slightly as a director of the contractor who's building. The reason they're late is anytime you change anything, you have to update the safety case. And the safety case process takes 12 months. Put the documentation in, goes to the thing, goes to the orders. What we've done with Hinkley is we have a full digital model of the civil structure, the containment shell, including modeling the reinforcement down to less than a millimeter. And we've managed to get the nuclear regulator in the UK to agree we can do digital safety case updates. So if you move the rebar by 2 mil, the safety case no longer applies. You're supposed to do a 12-month update. Right? Whereas now, it takes us 2 weeks. We've done multiple safety case updates in the last 4 years getting ready for this job. So I got yelled at in a very polite, collaborative, friendly kind of way that innovation people get yelled at. When I invested money in doing this for Hong Kong, and I got a little note of thanks from the project director at Hinkley saying, you are literally saving us hundreds of millions of pounds. every time we do one of these things, all through the use of the digital wall. So again, it's a Captain Obvious. I'm just going to show you that picture again. I really like it. So, no new information. It's the picture I showed you before. I really like it. So, we have one of these where we put a 747 in that cavity. It fits. It's not a real 747. But it's, you know what I mean? It's a digital model of one. All right. The other thing where the digital... So that's sort of the engineering approaches. But Bayswater is a little great step. So changing the... Removing a level crossing in Melbourne, having the train line go over the road. I don't have, this is one of our community engagement days, so I don't know who this man is, I wasn't there. This is the digital engineer on the job took this from me. I do not have his permission to show you this picture. I'm using the Oral-B defense for all lawyers. This is the Oral-B defense, you know this really well. Remember that ad, TV? This man is a dentist, we can't show you his face on TV. That's the Oral-B defense. So you can't see who he is, so I'm good. He was a local resident living in a house next door who absolutely cracked the shits with this job because he was worried he was losing his view because this thing goes up and out. And he came into one of our days and he just, like, he was waving his walking stick around and he was a cranky old man. And so what we're doing here, that's an Xbox controller. You've seen Oculus virtual reality headsets? This is a VR system. So Oculus are the original one. It belongs to Facebook now. There's every man and his dog has a VR headset now. The Oculus were the first ones out there, not the best. And this is one of the old ones that we started out development work on. He is going for a walk through the model, the rendered computer game rendered model of the finished asset. He's just going for a little walk through. And at the beginning, he'd never used an Xbox before, so John was showing him what to do, and he was like, John was moving him around, and he grabbed it from John, and he was off. So this photo was taken 5 hours into a two-hour community engagement day. And he wouldn't go until he walked up and down and up and down and up and underneath him. And then what we did, we showed him what it looked like from his family lived, and we showed him what it looked like from standing on his front steps. And then he was happy. So we get more value out of doing this from our digital models than any of the other stuff that we talked about, including the nuclear safety case, right? This is gold. So this is innovation in practice. Now, this photo is about a year old now, but it is my favorite photograph in all of my time working with Langer Orbis. And just to give you an idea of sort of where the cutting edge is, this is a development we're doing in North Sydney at the moment called 100 Mount Street. What you're seeing is there's a Microsoft product called HoloLens, which isn't available in Australia yet. So don't tell anybody we've got this because we're not supposed to have it. I stole it from somebody who got it via Canada. Australia, so we've just borrowed it. Anyone from Microsoft? So you're in the HoloLens. It's basically an untethered augmented reality, virtual reality platform. So you put a digital overlay over the real world. So this is our model. We've done for community engagement days on Mount Street. So you can go along to the site office, they've got one of these there, you can put it on, and you can say, you know, show me the internal structure. It's voice command system. It's actually really cool. So that if you've ever worn a HoloLens, they're pretty heavy actually. You can wear them for 15 minutes and your head goes forward. But the tech evolves so quickly that the iteration number two weighs 1.5 kilos less than iteration number one. They're all untethered. Eventually they'll be in your glasses like a Google Glass, but it has all of this functionality. So that is basically the cutting edge in VR as it's applied to construction at the moment, as near as I know. And that's a very low resolution model because we were using the full chip capacity that was in that device. So if you're interested, 100 Mount Street has a website. And I know that Dexus are looking for, it's a Dexus development. Dexus is part of Langer Orbis. They're looking for tenants still, so if you're interested, it's a beautiful building. All right, so number one, digital model. Second thing you need, and once you've got a digital model, you can begin to explore different delivery methodologies. So the one that we prefer is known as design for manufacture and assembly. And in the spirit, again, of sort of academia, we have plagiarized that whole concept from elsewhere. But because you reference it, it's okay. See, that's how academics get away with stuff. So DFMA, as it's known, is actually an aerospace concept. Here's an example from Boeing. I could have used the equivalent slide from Airbus, except Airbus doesn't manufacture any components in Australia. Whereas these trailing wing edges come from a factory outside of Melbourne, so I use the Boeing example. So you have a full digital model of your asset, in this case an airplane. It's broken up into components. The components are designed to be manufactured using a global supply chain, and they're brought together and assembled in the most efficient way. So there's real-time information about logistics, materials handling, all that sort of stuff. And ironically, BlackRock has a technology sharing agreement with Airbus and Boeing. So I know for the Airbus thing, they can do full certification of their plane. They can tell you if the plane will fly or not just from the digital model. Right? They will certify that it can fly. You're not allowed to do that yet. The aviation authorities won't let you get away with without doing a test flight. But they're perfectly happy that you can do it like that. So that is where we will get to in this space. So I wanted to show you a couple of examples about what it looks like when you apply it to construction. Right, so pop quiz number two. You're batting 0 from 1. We start at the moment. Anyone know where this is? It's one of the engines of Australia's GDP for most of the last 50 years.
Gorgon?
Not quite. This one's an iron ore facility. It's very close to Gorgon, though. It's Cape Lambert. It's Rio Tinto's primary iron ore export facility. And again, this is a project. Most of what you see there, in one form or another, is built by Lambert. Not the jetties. But pretty much everything else over the last sort of 30 years. The last set of jobs that we had there, it's a very traditional job. The client and the client's engineer are very traditional the way that this was delivered. They give you a big stack of 2D drawings like this, which you have to price. You give back to them a price and a schedule and a bunch of other stuff. What we do then is we turn that into a 3D model, because the 2D drawings are of no interest to me. I can't do anything clever with that. And then in order to make them happy, we have to give them a document back that explains how you turned the drawings into a model, which is a little bit ironic, but it's okay. So, and then what we did on this project for the first time, we made each of the components. Now, this is a transfer station for conveyor belts. One comes in under here, one comes in here. We made each of these components intelligent. We put a little computer chip on them for the first time. So it knew what it was, where it belonged, whether it was on time or late. They went on in the factory. These modules were manufactured in Thailand. They went on in the factory. We were tracking the ship as it came down the coast. So we knew if the ships were being hijacked or not. Not hijacked the ship. Final transfer station. So that's what it looks like in the model. This is a little component. And that's what it looks like going into place. So anybody who's ever worked on a remote project, my very first job, proper job as an engineer, was in the mines in Western Australia a long time ago. One of the major challenges is mental health issues with your workforce. There are sort of five or six times worse mental health outcomes for a fly-in, fly-out workforce than there are for somebody who lives at home, works in community business for a month. So this job, every month you get a ship with 40 modules on them. The crew would drop them in and it'd take 4 days. Usually sometimes it took 5 days. And then they'd go home. Whereas the other roster, about 2 kilometres that way, there's another crew doing a stick build project, so bringing in the raw materials and assembling the plates. They were working at 4 weeks on, 1 week off. And you work it's a 14-hour day. It's really hard work, actually. I would do 4-day visits to this site, and at the end of the fourth day, I was so cactus. I was incapable of having a proper conversation. I was so tired. They're up at 4, they're on the job by 5:30. They're off the job, back to the buses at 6, in bed at 7:38. And you do that 28 days straight. If that's not a recipe for mental health issues, I don't know what it is. So anybody who thinks that's a good idea has got lost there. So again, this is another one of these capital pieces. When you see it done, it's a no-brainer. This is an example where it's done in the building sector. This is the banking district in London. The one that I want to show you is this one here. It's called it's the Leadenhall Building. It's known as the Cheese Grater. Lord Rogers, who's the architect, really cracks the shits when anyone calls it the Cheese Grater. But it looks like a cheese grater, so what was it thinking? So that is a Langerhorne job. It was the only one delivered during the GFC early and on budget. Let's see if this works. What I want to show you, this is part of the big video that won the job, and it shows you the construction scenes in the model. So skip forward, the last bit's a bit boring, putting on the facade and then see that. So there was no concrete, no wet concrete poured on that job above the jump wall. So level 2.5 front. It was all prefab. The steel came from a factory in Ireland. The MEP, the services modules at the back, the yellow ones, came from a factory in Wolverhampton to the north. The mega brace came from Czechoslovakia in components. So 85% was manufactured off-site using that methodology, that DFMA, Design for Manufacturing Assembly methodology we just talked about. And it didn't pull 6 months off the program, it pulled 9 months off the program. So telling stories out of school, we've never done one, had never done one high-end commercial building before anywhere in the world. We were the 12th reserve on the original bid list. Any of you have ever met the founder of Langer Rourke, he's quite a charismatic character, and he sort of argued his way in, and they said, look, if you go away, we'll put you on the shortlist, which was went from 5 to 6. And then we did this work, and we said, look, we can do it it was a 4-year build, was the best that they had. So we'll do it in 2 years and 9 months. And they're like, you can't, it's not possible. You know, you're amateurs, we need your amateurs. And he said, well, we'll give you a guarantee, our risk, right? And it came in 2 years and 9 months, and one day, it was time complete. But we're okay with that. And it is a spectacular success. That building sold recently. So I know what we built it for, which I can't tell you. And I know what it sold for, it was £1.2 billion, which is a large multiple of what it cost to build. And it's had 100% occupancy the entire time. So you can do it in mining, you can do it in building. And that is the factory, that's our factory in the UK. It's in the middle, it's in the geographic centre of the UK. But that model, I know, doesn't work for Australia, otherwise you've got a factory in Alice Springs. Can't see that working. But it's the most advanced manufacturing facility for construction products, in this case concrete and concrete components, that I've ever seen. I'm not aware of a more advanced one. So the rebar is done using robots, usually, not these two blokes welding on handy. It's got 3 carousels. It's a really advanced. So most of the concrete components for Lentil came from this. This is a DFMA bridge. This particular example is it's a metro rail bridge. It's dropped in over the M60 outside of Manchester. So anybody who's ever been to the north of England knows that the M60 is a car park most days of the week. They just couldn't countenance shutting down the road for 6 weeks while you build the bridge. So we dropped it in overnight, went in a 12-hour shift. And we're going to do one of these for the first time ever in Australia on a road project in South Australia at the back end of this year. It'll be a drop-in bridge. We've given ourselves 3 days to do that. The project director's a bit nervous. Never been done before. And we've also done with, in this case, a solar farm. So Sunshift is a spin-out from my little innovation team. It now belongs to our Australian business. It's a modular redeployable solar farm. This was the prototype that we did. It was on an oil and gas project in central Queensland. Very grateful for funding from ARENA and the federal government to get this to go. So Sunshift is a success. It's been spun out. It's turning over many, many millions of dollars in products. It's about to do another round of product development. It's the same philosophy, the DFMA philosophy. All right, how are we doing? Okay. How's my time going? Okay, so first thing you need, digital model. Second thing is different delivery methodology. Once you've got those two things, then you can start using different delivery tools, different manufacturing tools. So I'm starting to get more interesting stuff now. And we're sort of moving into the realm of what's known as additive manufacturing or 3D printing. Anyone familiar with this car? It's a very famous car, this car. It's the world's first 3D printed car. So it's actually made of Lego, which doesn't instill a huge amount of confidence, but it was 3D printed. So here's a couple of shots. Anyone own a 3D printer? Outstanding, well done.
I know.
Oh, that's cheap. Okay, take your hand now. So do you know how they work? Right? Remember the old dot matrix printers? And they put a layer down. Right? And you're just putting dots down. So the 3D printer, you just work in the third dimension as it goes up. Right? So this is what they're doing here. They're printing a layer of ABS plastic, which is what Lego is made from. And then they do it up in the third dimension. Right? And the reason it's called additive manufacturing as opposed to subtractive manufacturing, which is traditional sculpting, right? You start with a block of marble and a chisel and a hammer, and you take away. Additive is you only put material where you need it. So in theory, there's zero waste. You can see it's not perfect. But this was the first time anybody had ever done a car like this, so go easy. Right? Everybody's a critic. And then they added in the substructure of the electrics, the drive system, and then they drove it down the red carpet, right? As you do in Hollywood, it's a Californian company. So that's what it looks like today. It's available for pre-order. It's a bit less than a mini. Anything you see there, right? Color, texture, shape, the headrest, whatever you like, is customizable to whatever you want at no charge. Right? All you do is change the digital model, press a button, your car spits out the other end. So it's about 70% 3D printed. I reckon that's pretty good. I'm going to go with that. So that's not bad. Some more examples of 3D printing. This one's from Airbus. This is a titanium frame. So really interesting. I digress a little bit and get all geek on you here. There's an algorithm that's used to mimic how nature develops structures. So you start with a solid block of aluminium, and then the computer algorithm takes out a lump and then runs a finite element model to see what the structural performance is like. And then it goes back and it takes out another lump, takes out another lump. And you do that iteratively until you optimize the structure. So that is the least amount of metal you can get away with that has the right structural performance. And you can't cast that, it's impossible. You can only 3D print it. You do it like that, right? So the challenge here is that actually customers are not used to it. It looks like you're driving around a motorbike that came from the Alien movies. And that's a problem, as it is today. We've done steel beams using the same algorithm, and it looks like something out of an alien spaceship. And you've got 40% less steel for the same structural performance in a girder. It just looks a bit funny. And if you talk to BlueScope about it, they call security. So, but we get that a lot. So. And there's a really important lesson there about innovation and incumbency, which I'll happily talk about it again. Apologies in advance. This is work from my other life. It's not my things, but I do lots in medical implants. So these are 3D printed scaffolds for ears and the pinky bone. So what you do is you take this scaffold, it's a medical grade polymer, you dunk it in a broth of stem cells, and then stem cells are really interesting. If the surface structure is the right shape, then you can grow whatever cell you like. So the way it works in the body, the composition is not important, the shape is more important, right? So these are a bit icky. And that's what you end up with, right? Yeah, and this is old tech. This is Generation 3. We're up to Generation 8 now. So there's a company in Melbourne that does knees and hips printed in titanium that are designed just for your body, the shape of your socket. It's not a generic thing that's cast. And then your surgeon, anybody ever had the privilege of watching an orthopedic surgeon go to work? It's dead set carpentry, and there's bits of bone going everywhere. It is the most disgusting thing I've ever seen. At least it wasn't until I passed out. So this is tailored to the individual at no extra price because they're 3D printed. So that's probably the most advanced company that I'm aware of in Australia, and nobody's ever heard of it. And this is the last frontier in health. This was hearts. You couldn't 3D print hearts. So this is a piece of work from the back end of last year from Harvard. So these are lab on a chip, grown with individuals' heart cells. So it's personalized medicine. So they take a sample of your blood or your biopsy from your heart. They grow these little labs on a chip, and then they can tailor the medicine specifically to you and your conditions. And these are 3D printed, these little circuit boards. So that's quite interesting, I think. So if you can 3D print a heart, you know, and we're still casting bricks out of mud, I think there's probably a lesson there for us. This is chocolate, and I know that this is it's 20 plus years old. So Cadbury had a research lab in Cambridge where I did my PhD when I was a PhD student. Behind a locked door on the top floor were these four enormous wheelie bins with a broken padlock on it that had been cut with a pair of bolt cutters. And it was a PhD student's because it was waste from an experiment when they were printing chocolate, right? So because it was an experiment, they weren't allowed to eat it. But that is what all the PhD students did for food. So they had a pair of bolt cutters, cut the log and eat as much chocolate as you can carry. So this is where it's at today. Where we've got, so this is Langerhall's Go 3D printers. It's called Freefab. So Bessie is the robot. Pretty sure Bessie's the world's largest 3D printer. She's 36 meters long, 12 meters wide, 6 meters high. I can print a building with Bessie. I don't, because that's too complicated for my operating business. They're like, well, you know, why would we do that? So what I do is I print molds for casting complex shapes. So Bessie is being used on, and I'm not allowed to tell you the project. Bessie is being used on Europe's largest construction project. I haven't even said that, right? So please ignore the sign on the right-hand side. So what we had to do with Bessie, that's James. James is not 3D printed. He's the inventor of the Freefab suite of technologies. We had to do a mock-up, a full-size mock-up of these complicated panels. They're for underground station lines. And if I'm honest with you, they didn't do parametric modeling, so there are 600 unique shapes in one of these structures. And actually, if you'd done your job properly, you could have got away with 60. And so if you've only got 60 molds, I can't afford to pay for a £5 million robot. But if there's 600 molds, I'm printing money for this job. So happy days to the architects who designed these structures. And we're in the process. I'm cranky because we couldn't do the first deployment. All of the R&D for this, all of the development work is done in Australia. Our test centre is near Sydney Airport here. It just so happened that the first project was in the UK. We'll spin Freefab out soon. The global construction market is $15 trillion. And it's ripe for disruption. We'll spin Freefab out of this. All right. Digital model, different delivery methodology, different manufacturing tools. Then the fourth thing you can do is you make your asset intelligent. You're basically giving it a nervous system. So if I cut my finger, my body knows it's been cut. It knows how badly it's damaged. It can go about self-repairing, right? But if a bus drives into the corner of the building has no idea. So we're talking about giving buildings nervous systems. So this is work that's come from the University of Cambridge. This is one of our projects in the UK. The PhD student was afraid of flying, so I couldn't get him out to Australia, so we did it in London instead. All of these cages, these are foundation cages. The traditional model is this blue thing here. It's called an Osterberg cell. It's 100,000 pounds, it's a single point source, gives you information about stress and strain in the column. Really expensive, and when the battery runs out, you lost your thing after 2 months. So what the Cambridge, the smart little smarty pants at Cambridge did, he's come up with a technique for using optical fiber. And he puts the optical fiber on the column, tensions it out, pulses light through, gives you the same information. So the optical fiber costs you 10 cents a meter. 100,000 quid, single use, or 10 cents a meter. So we instrumented all of the foundations on this project. And again, little trade secret between you and me, every second one of those columns wasn't required. You know? So if you're measuring in real-time performance, then the opportunities for giving a performance guarantee for an optimized structure are enhanced. Because without that information, we are not going to build you and then give you a performance guarantee for anything that's not over-engineered. Right? But in this case, you can do that. So the London Underground are a really early adopter of this tech. They've got a test tunnel that has millions upon millions of pounds of things looking at cracks and deformations and tunnel linings, and all of it gets replaced by a 200 quid bit of optical fiber that runs the length of the tunnel. So then you've got sensors across your asset, whether it's a long linear asset like a railway line or a road, or a building, or an oil and gas facility or a water treatment plant. Then you're into the realms of what everybody calls big data, which I don't like. It's not about the data, it's about the insights that you derive or the knowledge that you get. So I prefer the term massive analytics, and it leads into the realm of artificial intelligence. So the best example I can give you is this. That is all of the email traffic in Langerhall, in Australia, for 1 week in January 2015. And what we were doing, we run it through a big data algorithm that one of the little smarty pants in my group wrote. There's an intern was with us for the summer. It took him about 30 minutes to pull the algorithm together. And the hypothesis we were testing here is we're trying to correlate profitability in a project. So the offices and the projects are different colors. We're trying to correlate profitability with centeredness. So how close to the center is the project, and does that correlate with profitability? So the hypothesis is not a profitable project, a very profitable project, Lewis head office, a very profitable project. Right. Turns out we only have one project in Australia that's in court at the moment. It's very unusual for us. We have a very good business in Australia. That's this one. And this one printed money. Contractors are very happy with a 5% margin. That one was a good project. So we use this now. This is a couple of years old. We use it as a management tool. It's another piece of information in the arsenal about how we do stuff. The other thing that's really important that we do now is we look for these people. These are individuals. They are the most important people in our organization. They are the connectors. So we're a projects business, right? We deliver projects. The stuff that I don't do is not our core business. Our core business is delivering projects. We don't care if it's a nuclear power station or Heathrow Airport or whatever, right? It's a project. Those people that connect projects back to the organizational resource are the most important people in the organization. So we now know who they are. They go right up on the talent management stuff. They're the people who connect business, and they are the architects of profit or loss, as it turns out. So this is a really simple example of what big data can do, let alone if you've instrumented your roadway and it tells you, you know, that square over there needs maintenance, but the rest of it doesn't. So don't come along and resurface the whole thing. Right, just dig down here and patch it here, or did it with a railway line, that sleep is gone. That sort of stuff. So, how we go? Yeah, doing all right? Okay. So then once we've got all of that, then we start looking at some of the things we were talking about before, about robotics, automation, and computer vision. Actually, that title's around the wrong way. All of robotics starts with computers that can see. You must have a computer that can see first, and then you get into automation, and then you're moving into robotics. So the slide behind it is all of the things that we use drones for today. This one I really like. This was our first use of a drone in Western Australia. It is the early works for that Burswood Stadium station. It's now pretty much finished in Perth. And we did a little pack. The drone went up every hour, a couple of hours in the morning. Did it again in the afternoon. We didn't tell the site team we were doing it. But we give a little pack of information to the project director and said, the project director said, where's my other bulldozer? And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. It's like, I'm missing a bulldozer. The next morning it was back. The next afternoon it wasn't. The next morning it was back again. And it wasn't being used yet. It had just been mobilized. It wasn't supposed to be used. Turned out somebody was borrowing the bulldozer and doing some other work with it. And then we'd bring it back again for the security guards to do their whip around the corner. So that was interesting. Turns out Mr. Bulldozer Borrower doesn't work for us anymore. The other one that I really like and we use all the time is the one in the top right-hand corner. It's a commoditized service from a drone thing now. It's volumetric analysis, so your earth-moving subcontractor says, here's my bill of quantities, I moved 10,000 cubic meters today, and the project director pulls out her iPad and says, actually, you moved 8.5, and you moved to the wrong place. So tomorrow you can do the right thing, and I'll pay your bill then. Right. When we first started looking at drones, there were two companies in the US that were well-known, and one little startup in Sydney. Today, as of the 30th of November last year, when we last did our index, there are 347 drone companies available for hire in Australia. In 2 years, it's become a commoditized service. You ring them up. I don't care about what hardware they put up. I want the data. It's the data that's available to me. So there's only one drone company we invest in, and they have a data platform, and their drones actually aren't very good. They keep falling over it. But their data platform is amazing, so that's why we're interested in that. And this was the first trial that we did, and this was fun. Again, I'm not allowed to tell you which client it is, so just ignore the guy in fatigues. This was in Sydney. It took us 12 months to get permission to put a drone up on this site. Right? And the first one we put up, I got really cross and told the engineer was doing it. I said, just put it up. They shot it down. As you do, it was like playtime at the zoo. It was ridiculous. So this one was a very expensive one. We got all the permits and everything else, we put it up. And it was monitoring a stockpile of hazardous waste because the surveyor said, I'm not going near that, mate. There's no way. So we did it from the, using the drone. So that's a very sort of trite example. All right. So computer vision. This is not my work. This is a really early piece of work from Google around the driverless car program. So this is what the camera sees in the car, and that is what the computer algorithm does with the data that the camera gives you. So this is all about computers that can see, right? So this is called SLAM system, simultaneous location and mapping. And what it does is it's plotting threats. So the little purple boxes might be a kid with a ball or a fluffy poodle or a grandma in a Zimmer frame, all that sort of stuff. In real time, as it goes along, it has to map that and work out threats, change the algorithm, update what's going on. Right? The challenge is the SLAM systems that you can buy commercially are three times the price of the Corolla that they're sitting on top of. So that doesn't work for me. I can't put one on every bit of kit and plant that we've got in Australia. So what we did instead was we made our own SLAM system. So this is it. It's in a little disguised housing. And I don't normally show this. This is one of our internal prototyping videos. So this is not done for public consumption. So that's Alex. He's doing his PhD in robotics. He helps us out a couple of days a week. He's one of our old engineers. Decided to better himself. He wrote the algorithms for this. Our SLAM system costs $150, right? So it's better than the $60,000 that the commercial ones cost, and that's the way it works. So what Alex is doing here is he's teaching the SLAM system, our SLAM system, and this is how artificial intelligence works, it has to learn. So he's teaching it to recognize a human. And then we managed to teach it the difference between a human and a chair. This was a huge breakthrough in the lab. And now, you know, this is where we've got to. So then you can start doing clever stuff like this. This was a really early thing. This is Rob in our storeroom, and the SLAM system has been taught to recognize if somebody's wearing PPE or not. And if they're not, to feed that back, right? So Rod is like, yes, he's got his vest on. The fact that he's wearing heavy armors and board shorts, that don't get hung up with that, right? But this time he's not wearing his vest. He's not allowed to be there, so the computer can make a picture, right? So this is what it looks like when we do stuff in the lab. This is what it looks like when we take it to site. So that is the same system. We call it a toolbox spotter. This is a little loop. Apologies, it's a bit Blair Witch Project. What I'm doing here, the person with the computer is standing in a rail corridor and just doing that. Right? That's all it is, and it's on a loop. And the thing about rail corridors, when you operate in a live rail corridor, you must have a spotter, a human spotter, who stands there. And they're really expensive, and it's a really difficult job because you've got to concentrate. So the computer is designed to become a human spotter, it's to replicate that. And the spotter on this project, it's a little rail project in Sydney, was cracking shits because he thought he was going to lose his job because the computer is marginally better. So he was hiding in the electrical cupboard. So it's the spotter's, our computer vision system designed two things. Plants incursions into a railway line, so that's why the excavator's in a blue box. And the blue says, yes, it's good, it's in where it's supposed to be, it's not into the railway line. And then it also identifies people. So I couldn't see the first time, but I know now, because I've seen this a lot, hiding in that cupboard as you pivot is a man in an orange shirt. He was trying to defeat the computer. And the computer says, yes, we found him. Right? So 8%, between 8 and 15% of all of our budgets for every rail project that we do is the cost of human spotters. It's a terrible use of labor, really unproductive. So we're starting to play with this, and because the system is $100, we can put it on all sorts of bits and pieces and then link it back in.
Does he still work for you?
Of course. Yeah. Those type of unskilled roles are the perfect ones for retraining. So I see the future of construction, because at the moment it's the last bastion of unskilled labor. You will have a smaller, more highly trained workforce. Enabling the robots or that sort of stuff. So it's not, I'm going to get to that now, so that's a good question. And I'll come back. This is an example, again, not mine. I love this video. Anyone seen it before? This is what happens when you combine robotics, DFMA, digital design, and a digital model all together. This is what it looks like. So again, this is a piece of work from a lab in the US. Don't get hung up on the fact that they're cheating a bit here. They've got magnets and the bits block into place, right? And there's not a fleet of PhD students in a back room using joysticks. These people solve the maths of swarm theory. So you know when fish move, or birds or insects, they don't bump into each other. That's what they're using here. So if one drone comes along with one part and sees another drone in the way, it reprograms, replans, picks up another piece or whatever, right? Does it in real time. So, you know, people ask me, is the future giant printers printing giant buildings? And no, I don't think it is. I think the future is micro, not macro. You will have a digital model of your asset, a bunch of little components get delivered in shipping containers, and you have an automated assembly fleet that does the assembly in silence, or near silence, 24 hours a day, right? Because it doesn't need lights, and see where it's going, it knows where it's going because it's in the model, right?
And then again,
when I first presented this to our global board, they were like, you know, Andrew, that's beautiful, but it's never going to happen. And I said, I beg to differ. Google's building a new headquarters in California at the moment. They did a market sounding like big clients do. It's quite a complicated design. It's a Thomas Hedderwick design. He's a very famous, quite quirky British designer. He's got a funky shaped roof. And the market information came back, yes, we're delighted to build your new headquarters. It's going to be $15 billion. And they're like, but it shouldn't, because these are the benchmark numbers. So Google, in the space of 3 months, designed, patented, and deployed a thing called a Crabot, half crane, half robot, that will build and assemble its structure. And the only thing that upsets me about this is that I didn't get to there first. So we will get disrupted in construction. It is absolutely coming. And it's almost certain that it will come from outside, not within. Right? It is the last great undisrupted industry, $15 trillion a year. If you're not going for that, everybody talks about moonshots or, you know, the billion-dollar startups. Construction is the last one that hasn't been hit yet. So this stuff is coming. I mentioned before, people worry about jobs. They're getting replaced by robots. That's not how it works. This is work from CETA, based on a US study. My colleague at Sydney Uni, Darren White, who is famous for a bunch of reasons, but he did the driverless trucks program for Rio Tinto. That was all his work from his lab. So he chaired this working group about where the impacts of robotics and automation, they called it computerization and big data, will come in the future. And everybody thinks it's, you know, people who flip hamburgers or low-skilled labor. Actually, it's really difficult to get a robot to make a hamburger. And can probably tell that I spend a lot of time on my personal appearance. My hairdresser, Franck, just spent hours on my hair every day, right? I don't want my hair cut by a robot. I want to look this good every day with Franck, right? And so also turns out that it's very difficult to get a robot to cut your hair, right? And to do simple things that are considered manual labor. And the other thing is, which I enjoy a little bit, my dad was a lawyer, he was a barrister, he's now retired. I like to poke fun at the legal industry. Most of the work that gets done can get done faster and cheaper by a computer, an artificial intelligence algorithm. Going through cases, preparing briefs, all that sort of stuff, you can do with the press of a button. So there are lots of good examples in that sector now. So actually, it's a bimodal distribution. There are lots of white-collar jobs that go. So the solution to having a future-proof job is to have a deeply creative element. Creative element, so like Frog, right, with my hair, because that's deeply creative, obviously. You're a tough audience. I'm going to skip that. I'm sort of moving forward into the picture. I'm almost done. So I was talking to somebody beforehand about, you know, what happens when you get biology and engineering in the same room. And I mentioned my other life. I grow gold on trees and reverse engineer butterflies. So this is some work from my other life. I didn't do this though. So this is an example known as biomimetic engineering. That's deriving inspiration from nature. So that is a map of the Tokyo, sort of the greater Tokyo railway network. It was developed largely after the war. Millions upon millions of man hours, usually man hours, there weren't so many female engineers involved, to optimize where you need the railway line to match with the population, right? That's because that's the key to urban transport planning. This is slime mold. Anyone seen slime mold before? So unicellular organism grows on trees, usually in wet environments. Reminds me of growing up on the Gold Coast. So slime mold has two things it does in life. It wants to eat and reproduce. That is it, nothing else. This is what happens when you use slime mold to design a railway network. So what this guy at the University of Tokyo did, he had a petri dish shaped like a bay, and then he put oat flakes where the major population centres were. So the oat flake is the slime mold's favourite food. And then over 26 hours, he let the mold go out, contract, go out, contract, and come up with an optimised network of the shortest distance to the major population centres for the minimum expenditure of energy, right? And this is what the slime mold comes up with for the network, and that's what it looks like at the moment. That is 26% more efficient. You don't have these connections that you don't need, like this one up here, for example, right? So we've done this. There's nobody from Transport for New South Wales. I got in trouble once showing the optimised network for New South Wales. This is what this experiment looks like for New South Wales. With the optimised network, and that's the real network. So I can save them a couple of dollars by doing an experiment that took us 2 days and required us to go and hack a tree that has in Sydney University's grounds and that's the yellow mold from. So that's what happens when you get biology and engineering together. Turns out growing gold on trees is really easy to do. It was one of my early startups that we gave to a mining company to use to rehabilitate land up in Newtown. This is another example, more recent, that I quite like, actually. This is work from the Technical University of Delft in the Netherlands, looking at how you can have self-healing concrete. So it's the last thing I'm going to talk about. So it's the self-healing concrete. So the concept of a self-healing material is quite interesting. So there's a hole in a concrete panel. It's a broken concrete panel. What you do is, with this, you just spray a little solution on it, and then it heals itself. So there are bacteria, bugs in there. So this is really interesting. So I got a sample of this, and I imported it from the Netherlands into the UK, and I tested it in that factory I showed a picture of before. And it was a spectacular failure. It didn't work at all. Right? And that was because I wasn't there, and I just said to the guys in the factory, here's the squirty thing. Right? Go and squirt it in the crack. Take a picture every morning for the next 6 weeks. And they did, and there was no change. Turns out they were doing it in the middle of winter. It was like minus 40 in the damn factory. And the bugs like 35 degrees and a nice wet environment. So it turns out I don't need the Dutch bugs. That indigenous bacteria is everywhere. You take a sample of soil in Australia, the bugs are in it, they form the bugs. So we've done it here, and it works gangbusters. So it doesn't repair structural cracks, but it does repair little architectural ones. It's a big deal in the UK. You get a hairline fracture in a concrete panel because the sky leaks permanently. You can see where the cracks are because they're wet and they show up. So that's what we use it for. All right, that's me done. I hope you get something out of that. I can take some questions on yourself. Otherwise, I'd like to be here. Thanks very much.
Any questions at all?
Jumping back, are you going to implement it all in your own business?
When's your 3D printer coming to Australia?
Yeah, so we've had a couple of offers to do some work here. I'm going to spin it out as a separate business first. A couple of lessons around how you do innovation. So that tech is so disruptive that the right place for it is not inside an incumbent business, including ours. I'm allowed to spend a great deal of money on innovation, on R&D, partnerships, all that sort of stuff, and I spend more than I would be able to get away with if we were a listed company. But even in layer all, with the full support of the owners, the chairmen, the shareholders, and management boards, I can't make this work. So we need to do it externally. And then we'll be a bit choosy about the next markets that we go after. Types of projects only come along very rarely. The major market for funky-shaped concrete is actually in theme parks. And the Disney Corporation spends about $4 billion a year upgrading theme parks. And they're all sort of those Magic Mountain things. So that is an opportunity. And we don't work in the USA, so the business needs to be a different business. But if we get one in Australia, now the most expensive precast panel that I'm aware of is actually in Sydney here. It's $250,000 per square metre of panel. It's on Westfield in Pitt Street, so it's Celtic Knots. You walk past. If somebody had asked me, I could have done that panel for $1,000. That is the power of that technology. We didn't know what's going on. Nobody asked us. We'll know about the next one. But when somebody's doing one of those again, then that'll pay for the development of the robot.
Any questions?
Yeah.
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 Y
Richard, does the innovation mean that the tallest buildings will now be exceeded? Because there's a presently sort of limitation due to the technology. But does it mean that they can now continue to go upwards?
So I think they could already. So the my structural engineer who works for me here, his name is Angus McFarlane. Angus is 163. when he joined the group, he increased the average age in the office by 40 years, I guess not. Angus did the Burj Khalifa, the world's tallest building. He's the design engineer for that. So there's nobody in Australia who knows more about ultra-tall buildings than Angus. And he's disgusted, I paraphrase, by the state of our high-rise development here. He thinks we just aim far too low. Everybody's ultra-conservative. So he reckons you could do it. And the Burj Khalifa is on sand. There's no footings. It's on sand. Turns out it's quite a good footing. So he reckons we can do it already. If you were to use some of the advanced materials we were talking about, graphene, carbon nanotubes, mixed in with concrete and cement, this building material, for example, you can certainly go higher. You have much smaller columns. As a biomimetic example, we have a column sample in the lab that mimics the structure of a dandelion stem. So if you chop a dandelion stem through the middle, it's a really porous structure. It's got these sort of tendrils that go out and lots of little holes in them, and then a reinforced external circumference. So there is 50% less material than a solid core post-tension thing. So that lets you have a column that's half the size, so then you get increases in net lettable area, and there's a whole bunch of things that developers like. That will come first before we go higher. So, but the answer, the uncomplicated answer is yes.
You've got sort of like innovation and Langerhall construction. Construction, as you said, is a really high volume, low margin, tons of time. How have you been able to actually get funds from a corporation into all this wonderful research? Because a lot of this stuff, I mean, it's a lot of thinking, it's a lot of investment for which you might get ideas, take a long time to implement. How have you been able to sort of bridge that?
So the role that Langerhall was their idea, not my idea. I was introduced to them by a colleague that I have known for a long time in the UK, who in turn had the year of the shareholders. And we had a conversation for 2 years about what he wanted to do, and I kept because I didn't think he was, like, wasn't right. So we had this 2-year courtship where he said, no, this is what I want, this is what I want, this is what I want. What needs to happen in order to make that work? So after 2 years, I said, all right, obviously serious, this is what it needs to look like. So we are in a separate physical location from our operating business. We're in an innovation lab that's just across the road from Sydney U. Today, we use it as a show and tell for most of our clients. They get to come through really early before a job comes to market. And we can show them what the implications of robotics automation of 3D printers. We can knock up a digital model of their asset and tell them what it will cost within 5% by pressing a couple of buttons, that sort of stuff. So the driver for it comes from the shareholders at Langerhall. And without the high level, without the right culture and the high level support, it would not be successful. If I was in an ASX listed company with a quarterly reporting cycle and I sit on the board of one ASX company, it's a disruptive sort of energy play. The compliance for that drives me insane. It just does me in. And I don't have that level of scrutiny in a private company. There are a lot of lessons that we've learned about how you deliver innovation. The 3D printing projects, we kept it internally in stealth mode. I didn't tell them we were spending that money on that for 2 years. And then only when we were ready to go, because it only takes longer than a year, it's dead or whatever. So that was a 3-year gestation to that point. So when we had a year to go, I said, I think we should, you know, this 3D printer thing we're doing. And I got a call from his 2IC saying, so Andrew, just tell me, are we going to print buildings? And I'm like, no, that's a stupid idea. And he's like, good, because if you said we were, I was going to fire you. You know, I had permission to fire you. And of course we're going to print buildings, right? But they weren't ready for that. So today, if they ask me the question, are we going to print buildings? I'm like, absolutely. He's like, good, because that's obviously the next step, isn't it? So that, you know, that's the environment. So you have to really know your customer, right? It's like, you know, 101, sort of marketing 101. And it's the same principle. You need really high level support. Innovation is all around the people. So I have very, very highly qualified, the best structural engineer in the country works for us. And he does it because he gets to plan all sorts of things that are extraordinary. He's an extraordinary engineer. He's the best mentor of young engineers I've ever met. So I joke about him being 160, but actually he's outstanding. He adds value to us every single day. And he's a delight to work around. And that's the environment I want. I want an environment where you can have young and old. You know, I've got a big data team of 12 engineers at the moment. And when I was hiring them, they're like, we don't know your company. Like, it's not in the list of the top 5,000 IT companies on the country, on the planet, right? And I'm like, we don't go in for those lists. And I only told them afterwards that we're a construction company. And it doesn't matter because I need the skill sets. So, I like to buy my labor cheap, get them young, train them up, indebt them, make sure they jump anywhere else. So.
Right. Wrap it up. We've got to give you time to drink all our drinks. So thanks very much, Andrew, and really appreciate that.
That was Professor Andrew Harris of the University of Sydney and Langer Rourke. For more information on innovation in construction, please visit chryson.com.au.